The largest country in the world, Russia. The word alone conjures up all sorts of memories in our minds. A complex motherland depicted in films as diverse as Dr. Zhivago and From Russia with Love, pioneers in the space race, home of the Sputnik, a dangerous power to be dealt with during the Cold War. And in present times, just last week, Vladimir Putin ordered large-scale military exercises in the Black Sea, projecting power towards Europe and the Middle East. While Fashion Week in Moscow got underway, with Louis Vuitton, Armani, and Hermes luxury clothing in the windows of the GUM department store right across the street from the Kremlin. Russians spend between $6 and $10 billion annually on luxury clothes and accessories. Three astronauts, two Russian, one American, blasted off from the Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan last week and reached the International Space Station in under 6 hours. Yesterday in Moscow, there were plaudits from everyone from hard-bitten street protesters to Kremlin-linked billionaires about the late Margaret Thatcher. 82-year-old Mikhail Gorbachev said, "She was a striking person who will remain in our memories and in our history," unquote. The U.S. remains hopeful that Russia may influence North Korea during this current building of tension over nuclear threats. Russia is looking at new oil exploration in the Arctic Ocean as the ice cap shrinks due to climate change. It's already the world's leading net exporter of energy, since its production of energy still greatly exceeds its demand. Russia, what a complex, diverse, fascinating country. And today we are honored to have a speaker who understands it very well. Dr. Dick Farkas is a professor of political science at DePaul University in Chicago. And since 2009, he's been vetted by the Fulbright Program and the U.S. Department of State as a senior specialist for Balkan affairs. He's traveled and researched in Eastern Europe for more than 40 years, has served as a consultant to major corporations focusing on business in those regions, and is the author of numerous publications on Eastern European and Russian politics. He even has a new historical political novel in the works called Making Way. Today, he will give you a glimpse of the current political, economic, and social position of the largest country in the world, with a particular focus on energy and oil. When his formal presentation ends, there will be time for a Q&A, and we're aware that everyone has places to go, so we will adjourn by 1:30. Please welcome Dr. Dick Farkas.
Well, thank you. And let me be very brief in expressing my appreciation for the opportunity to be here with you today and to share some ideas. I'm going to begin by sharing with you some notions about politics and then about economics and then particularly about oil. Let me begin with something that I think is very important as we try to get the nature of Russian affairs in some focus. Americans are typically quite concerned about who runs Russia. And while we often focus on the single political leaders, that is the president, the truth of the matter is we need to be more thorough and more clear. Focusing simply on the executive leader is, in my view, not very wise and not adequate. So let me say a few things to you about the factions, strategies, principles, and challenges that exist for the leadership. And by doing this, I want to suggest to you that there's a bit of a similarity between what happens in the leadership in Russia and what happens with our leadership in Washington. In Washington, they often talk about the Beltway, things that happen inside and outside the Beltway. In Russian politics, it's typically discussed in terms of factions and pressures and interests inside and outside the so-called Garden Ring. Those of you that have been in Russia know, or in Moscow in particular, know that there are traditional ring roads, and that's what the Garden Ring represents. In particular, I'd like to share with you, and very briefly, the issues and factions that exist that the leadership today has to contend with inside the Garden Ring. There are three, really: the Siloviki, the Democratic Statists, and the Economic Reformers and the Technocrats. What I'm trying to suggest to you is that Vladimir Putin, and for that matter Dmitry Medvedev, don't singularly have the capacity to run the system without balancing the complex pressures of a modern political system. And so they are facing challenges from inside the Garden Ring that they need to massage and manage, and elements outside the Garden Ring. The ones inside the Garden Ring you see here, the Siloviki, which literally means force in Russian, includes the equivalent of the FBI, the CIA, Internal Affairs, Military Intelligence, and the Federal Narcotics Service. And what I'm trying to indicate to you is that they see issues in Russian politics through the prism of internal order. Virtually everything that they imagine salient about whatever issue it is that's being managed in Russia is seen through that prism. It's important for you to understand, as you read the journalism about Russian politics, that this is not a unified faction. And it's perhaps very important for you to understand that in spite of the fact that Putin comes out of the old KGB, he is not the spokesperson for the Siloviki. The Democratic Statists are the technicians of political power, again, inside the inner circle of Russian politics. They're the people we might call the bureaucrats, or the more significant bureaucrats, the people who run the various governmental agencies. They see everything through the prism of domestic affairs. And the euphemisms in Russian politics that they use for this vision, they use the term guided democracy or sovereign democracy. I can share just a little bit about that. This is a peculiar vision of democracy that's sketched in based on their own legacy, their own concerns, and their own sense about what democracy represents. Now, it's often said by people who study these things that the democratic statists have a liberal but not democratic vision. And that may be a little bit nuanced, but in political science, that would simply suggest that they perceive the need to embrace interests within the Garden Ring, but they're not concerned about extending the influence of various interests beyond the Garden Ring. That is to say, to the society at large. And Vladimir Putin, more often than not, reflects this vision. And finally, there are the economic reformers and the technocrats. They actually serve in Russian politics as a counterweight to the Siloviki and the statists. They're the economic reformers. They're the ones who press for globalization. And recently, American foreign policy and the foreign policies of many places in the world have granted WTO, World Trade Organization, status to Russia, in an attempt to enhance the position of the economic reformers and the globalization folks. Now, the factions outside the Garden Ring, and this is one of those areas where we have to learn to be more cosmopolitan and sophisticated about understanding Russian politics. We need to recognize the fact that the leadership, Putin and Medvedev in particular, understand the need for managing these interests. You'll notice there are regional power centers, the Peterzi, the Siviliki, the Finansi, and the Nationalists. Very briefly, Vladimir Putin has to contend with a number of regional power barons, power bosses, political bosses, whose interest is to keep tight political control, in particular for their own interests, maintaining homegrown corruption and control of patronage. These are very difficult for Putin to manage, and this particular strategy that you're going to see evolve between Medvedev and Putin reflects this challenge. The Peterzi are the power brokers and insiders from St. Petersburg. Most of you know that has a special status in Russian affairs, and Putin is very clearly in this subset of folks. The Siviliki and the Finansi are actually the responsibility of Medvedev. He's the one in the leadership duo who is responsible for managing and massaging those elements. You see here, the Siviliki are characteristically the interest groups, the NGOs, especially apart from the military or security interests. Putin can attack these folks as Medvedev massages them and creates a balance in Russian politics that keeps it from becoming explosive. The Finansi are sophisticated financial managers. They were doing very well until 2008. The global recession impacted their political influence, but they remain the young, business-savvy entrepreneurs, and Medvedev is their champion. Finally, the nationalists. These are the most difficult of the groups to manage for the Russian leadership, and it's generically all of those believing that Russia is superior to everyone and all other systems, and their appeal is essentially that the Russians are experiencing decline in world influence and that it's someone else's fault. Zhirinovsky, if you're familiar with Russian politics, is the spokesperson for that group. So what I'm suggesting to you is relatively simple, and that is essentially that we have to look well beyond the particular singular leaders to understand the dynamics of Russian politics. Now, the core political principles that the regime at the moment is articulating is commitment to a distinctly Russian form of democracy, which they call sovereign democracy. Sovereign, of course, simply means we get to define it our way. A commitment to the creation of a powerful state. For those of you who remember the organizational structure of the old communist system, it was a series of vertical structures. And the vertical of power is still very central to the Russian political mind, both the leadership and the mass public. They proposed to structure and manage political competition among factions, the point that I just attempted to make for you, by showing you something of the landscape that exists. Commit to economic reform. I think it's a very genuine commitment, a necessary commitment. They might argue a life-sustaining commitment, the only way the system can sustain itself. And finally, to commit to restoring a global role for Russia. A little bit of insight into Vladimir Putin himself. Born in 52 from working-class parents. I'll mention his problem with his age in a minute. Raised in a communal apartment, really very, very mundane background. He was a marginal, rowdy student, in fact. Was enamored with Soviet spy films, kind of a typical kid. Went to St. Petersburg, studied the law. Remember, that's an undergraduate major by our standards, a five-year undergraduate major, and stayed. Perhaps it's important to remember he stayed in the Communist Party until its demise. So he was not a rebel by any sense of one's imagination. You notice it says there, Sobchak, this is an old professor of his at the law school, who later became a reformer of the Gorbachev ilk in St. Petersburg, and Putin found a place by adhering his star to the rising political influence of Sobchak. Putin entered the KGB in 75. 75 to 85, he was in a really very mundane role, not realizing how the system actually worked. He finally discovered in 1985 that you don't get a foreign policy assignment unless you're married. He married, and in 1985 to 90, because of his rather marginal record, was sent to Dresden in East Germany. This is not a choice position for a KGB officer assigned abroad. In 91, he comes back and takes his job again with Sobchak in the city administration. His political career, of course, is the part that we know a little bit about. That frames itself in Moscow, where he becomes a part of a revolving door effort on Yeltsin's part to put people, young 30-somethings, in power, totally unknown people, so that Yeltsin could blame issues and problems and failures on someone other than himself. So this revolving door is turning. There are seven different prime ministers, and Vladimir Putin happens to be there when, in December of 99, Yeltsin decides to resign. And as a consequence, the prime minister becomes the acting president, and Vladimir Putin runs for office in March of 2000 and gets elected president. Of course, there is a more elaborate story associated with those things, but we don't have time to deal with that. Let me simply review for you the Russian presidential elections, just for perspective's sake. It was in 1996 that Yeltsin was in that runoff election with Zhuganov and was, in fact, for the very first time, elected to be president of the country of Russia. He claimed that position back in 1992, but of course had never been elected to that position, to be the president of a country. There's a very fascinating film that I've mentioned to some of you. If you're interested in the dynamics of that election, it really has a remarkable American link. Check out the B film called Spinning Boris. It's a fascinating story about three political consultants who go and engineer that election for Boris Yeltsin, and he barely wins by a hair over the communist leader in 1996. Putin gets elected by an early election that virtually cut the opposition off at the knees. It was scheduled 3 months earlier than planned. In 2004, Putin gets reelected, but at this juncture in time, he manipulates the political landscape by eliminating most of the other political parties in the system. In that election, the number of political parties that can legitimately compete went from 44 to 4, and none of the four are what we call democratic, small d, democratic political parties. In 2008, Vladimir Putin chooses, in fact, to abide by the Constitution, in spite of the fact that the Constitution has never been ratified. He chooses to consider it a credible document and decides not to run for a third term. That's when he taps Dmitry Medvedev with the support of his non-party political party called United Russia. And, in fact, Medvedev gets elected very easily. And then 2012, just a little over a year ago, Putin returns to run for president, wins again quite handily, and in the process chooses Medvedev to become his prime minister. So they change position, and they lengthen the term of the presidential election from 4 to 6 years. I wanted to show you very briefly the images and the effectiveness with which these images have been manipulated. There are lots of other things that can be managed here. But Putin has shown a Western-style sophistication about the need for him to tap into associations and identities that the Russian voter is interested. You'll see on the left the religious Putin, the macho Putin, the martial arts Putin, the tough guy Putin, the mysterious Putin, the warrior Putin, the sensitive Putin, the dog-loving Putin. The bottom line is that these are all very, very carefully managed political images. This doesn't surprise any of us that are Americans. We're accustomed to this kind of management of politicians' images, but I'm suggesting to you that this is a new dynamic and a dynamic by which Putin and Medvedev have been masterful at creating. During the last presidential election, Vladimir Putin said he was too busy to campaign, that were he to campaign, it would impede his ability to duly carry out his duties. I won't read all of these things to you, but you'll notice that it's an interesting array of things that he did during the campaign when he didn't have time to campaign, including singing jazz standards with Kevin Costner and Goldie Hawn. A little bit about Dmitry Medvedev. Medvedev was born in 65. That makes him 12 or 13 years younger than Putin. And he grew up in a very different environment. His parents were intellectuals. Unlike Putin, he was a strong student, calm, disciplined, confident, into his studies. He made money as a teenager bootlegging some of the music from some of his favorite rock groups that you see identified there. Both of them were christened into the Russian Orthodox Church. Both of them studied law in St. Petersburg in the same program. Both of them worked for Sobchak in the same external relations office. And both of them had their power base in St. Petersburg. Medvedev himself has a similar kind of experience going from St. Petersburg to Moscow, deputy chief of staff. He becomes Putin's campaign manager in 2000, not a particularly difficult campaign to manage since the outcome was a given. He was rewarded with the board chairmanship of Gazprom, the world's largest oil and gas company. He became chief of staff and subsequently worked himself through to the point where on December 10, 2007, Putin tapped him, a bit of a surprise, but tapped him to be the preferred candidate to take the presidency, so Putin would then become prime minister. Incidentally, the clarity of the relationship and the responsibilities between president and prime minister are ambiguous enough so that this relationship is very, very fluid. Characterizing Medvedev, one of the leading Russian experts says Medvedev is not an extremist. He's not known for any kind of harsh views on politics. He projects a mild-mannered public image and has been widely seen as a functionary devoted to Putin rather than an independent thinker. But perhaps his own words better capture his sense about politics. These are Medvedev's own vision of Russia. He says, Russia can only be governed by a strong presidential power. If Russia is turned into a parliamentary republic, it will disappear. This is my profound conviction. Russia is a federative state and must be based on a firm executive vertical. If that's a little bit thorny language, it means essentially that they believe in strong, highly centralized political leadership. Now, I wanted to share with you, going into this last presidential election, and certainly up to today, one of Putin's major concerns is that he thinks he's making changes that have traction for the long term in Russia. And there's some reason to believe that. With a six-year term, his next election, for which he can stand for re-election, is in 2018, which would make him president till 2024. Medvedev can then step in and become president till 2030 and can get reelected till 2036. So I'm fond of saying to young people, this is a pair of characters that's worth taking a close look at and coming to understand. Now, Putin would tell you, he's 60, he would tell you that he's losing some traction with young people, and it was a particular concern for him in the last presidential election. So he had two responses. One was to create an organization called Nashi. In fact, it's a little more shadowy than that. It's not clear that he created it, but it's rather clear that he endorses their activities. These are mostly male youths, 20-somethings. As I say, shadowy Putin support. Their purpose is to target and harass people who are anti-Putin and anti-Medvedev and anti-system. So they follow the American ambassador or the British ambassador around or dissidents and hassle them. Sometimes physically, so it's a little bit abrupt. These are a bit like thugs, essentially. But even more interesting, they created an organization called Putin's Army. Putin's Army is a bit of a misnomer. It's mostly attractive female youths in their 20s. They're emphatic groupies, Putin-Medvedev supporters, and they create a publicly visible generational endorsement. Let me show you a little bit about them. In the last election, they put on bikinis and had a car wash in Red Square, all right? And then they travel around on tandem bicycles. The Medvedev-Putin leadership is called the Tandem. They ride tandem bicycles around the city, again, as a visual way of capturing, in the Russian mind, the Russian voters' mind, that the young people support this regime, this direction, this leadership. You see here workout sessions under the watchful eye of Medvedev on the left and Putin on the right. This is more imagery that's really consequential. It's a new phenomenon in Russian politics, and they're doing it remarkably well. On the left there, he actually appeared and sang Blueberry Hill, of all things. I call that his Obama moment, right? Everybody gets to sing some popular tune. And, of course, the rooftop gardens that are being created under the watchful eye of agronomist Putin there. It's interesting. The tandem is essentially, it's called in Russian politics the bromance. It's a complex relationship, and I think what you need to carry away from all of this is essentially that they have a partnership of an extraordinary sort. There is intense mutual confidence between the two. But it is critically important that you understand that they are not political twins. They're not political twins. The reason I started out with those factions is so that you understand that they see politics in Russia as a complex juggling act, and that a single leader can't make the varied kinds of appeals in a complex kind of society and political system like the one they're living in and manage to appeal to everybody. The hypocrisy would be too obvious. So they don't do that, actually. They divide the labor brilliantly. Putin can attack NGOs while Medvedev is talking about strengthening them. They can talk about tightening up here and loosening up there. When Putin makes a decision about more control, Medvedev talks about reforms, about turning those controls to, you know, in time with consideration into reforms. So so Medvedev clearly has different preferences for support strata and is responsible for dealing with that. And the fact that they can so agilely manage the political system is really pretty impressive. I've already spoken to the fact that changing the term from 4 to 6 years is, I think, significant. In a December 12th survey, the Russian people were asked who the politician of the year was. 54% said Putin, 16% said Medvedev. What you and I have to do is combine those terms to understand the strength of the bromance. And in fact, in that same survey, they were asked what the main event of the year was, and they 49% said Putin's re-election, or not re-election in this case. Depends on semantics, doesn't it? Putin's election in 2012, but 23% of the Russians said Obama's re-election was the main political event of the year. So what I'm saying to you essentially, and this has an awful lot to do with the language that people choose to use when they look at Russian politics. You could argue that this is a manipulation of the political system. You could argue that it's simply effective administration or management. Whether it's sinister or pragmatic is a major debate among those people who academically, at least, study Russian politics. Putin and Medvedev declined to debate during all campaigns. They intimidate all those with the kind of wealth that could influence elections. They eliminate political parties from the landscape, especially democratic options. So today, the four political parties that have a right to run a candidate, you've got the United Russia, nondescript Putin folks, you've got a neo-fascist party, you've got a communist party, and the fourth party is actually one that was created by Putin to criticize his administration more vehemently than either the fascists or the communists, and in so doing, siphon off support for their electoral candidates. It's absolutely brilliant, in a simplistic sense at least. So he created an extreme party to siphon off support from the Communist Party, and the Liberal Democrats is the euphemism for that's the actual formal political title for the neo-fascists. And they changed the political term. Now the question, of course, long-term for politics, I think this is the last political thought here, is essentially what the administration would tell you, what Putin would say to you if he were here today. He'd say, we're having to centralize power in order to break the stranglehold of those who are resisting change. In order to make reform, we need to centralize power so we can decentralize the political system. That's something, incidentally, that Lenin said, Khrushchev said, and Gorbachev said. Now, that doesn't make it not true. In fact, that may validate the fact that from the perspective of Russian leadership, it is decidedly true. The Russian vision of the American-Russian relationship, the official position is that Vladimir Putin has repeatedly stressed Russia always has been and in the future always will be interested in further development of our bilateral relationship. And Medvedev has said recently the last 3 years of U.S.-Russian relations are the most productive ever. You'll notice that the accomplishments include a number of significant strategic arrangements listed there, START and the shelved long-range ABMs. And collaboration, which we don't hear much about, which involves using Russian bases to resupply NATO forces in Afghanistan, and a good deal of cooperation on drug trafficking. Turning to economics, the systemic performance of Russia, on balance, has got to be said to be respectable. Under the Putin-Medvedev leadership, they are doing better than I would have expected. The growth rate in 2012 was 4%. It's expected to be a little less. Public debt is 10% of GDP. That's not a particularly harrowing reality. And the GDP per capita is about $10,000. There are many parts of the world that would be happy to embrace those figures. The GDP has been rising since 98, since the 98 crisis, when you will remember that Russia went bankrupt, essentially, and defaulted on its loans, but the trajectory is positive. If you can believe the Financial Times, and I do, if you were to look at the G20, Russian economic performance as an economy is second only behind Saudi Arabia in the G20. So, in fact, that's reasonably impressive. Now, clearly you know that Russia and Saudi Arabia both have an advantage in terms of exporting oil and gas, something we'll get to in a moment. But Russia is the sixth largest economy in the world, But of course, it's tied directly to high oil prices. Putin himself would tell you that one of the primary problems that that he faces and that the regime faces and that the society faces is a demographic issue. He has said it's a disgrace that one in every two Russian men die before the age of 60. Not insignificant that he's 60. He set the goal of life expectancy to 75. It is currently at 58, just slightly above Ghana. Male life expectancy is a disaster, especially in an economy that's still labor intensive. He promises to increase the social welfare budget by 25%. That would be unbelievably remarkable, but will of course be contingent on oil revenue. The average per capita monthly income since 2000 has gone up 700%, from $81 to $614 a monthly income. Russians are aware of that. They sense that. That's good news by anybody's standard, and particularly theirs. Now, the bad news is that manufacturing is lagging and that job vacancies are remaining unfilled. Unemployment is about 5%, but new entrants into the labor force are way down. So for them, unemployment's not the problem. It's finding workers as the demographics become more and more ominous. In terms of markets, manufacturing capacity has been reached. That is to say, you certainly all know that the old transition from centralized planning and production to decentralized planning and private ownership has been awkward at best, and that manufacturing capacity has in fact nearly maxed out. Economically, they are dependent on Europe. 55% of their exports go to Europe, and when Europe gets into some difficulty, the Russian impact is dramatic. Household consumption is the main driver of growth. Most economists will tell you this is not a good thing. Imports are growing faster than exports. Imports are up 23%. Exports are up in this last year only 9%. I'm sure you all understand that the Russian ruble is still a soft currency. That means essentially that until Russia sells something for a hard currency, it can't go into the world marketplace and buy. And so the fact that it has a soft currency and that it's importing a great deal more than it's exporting is a real problem for the system at large. And West Siberian oil production is down. We'll get to the oil in just a moment. Consumer prices are up. In 2012, up 15%. Now, during the presidential campaign, the administration froze all food prices. So conveniently, in the run-up to the election, food prices weren't rising. But as soon as the election was over, they obviously leapt up. It's important for you to remind yourselves that Russia imports 40% of its food, and it has to pay hard currency, even to the old former parts of the Soviet Union, like Georgia or Armenia or Kazakhstan, for that food. Those places are demanding hard currency for their exports, and that becomes a terrible squeeze for the Russian economy. In the last 10 years, from 2003 to 2013, consumer prices have gone up every year, on average 13%, and 131% over the period. Just a quick word about economic reforms and psychology. A citizen survey in 2012 asked essentially, is good democracy more important than a strong economy? You see here the results. Russians said overwhelmingly the economy is clearly more important than democracy. Political dissent is growing, particularly over government spending and pension reform, and there are really no signs about the regime being able to implement the reforms about which it so prolifically talks. A very quick word about oligarchs, the super rich. It's important for you to know that visibility for these oligarchs in Russia is a cancer, and political ambition is suicide. That is to say, it's a very tough place to be rich, essentially. You really have to be you have to work at being invisible. Business rivalries are still settled violently in that part of the world. Capital once made is laundered in leaves. According to Medvedev, the outflow of capital in the last couple of years has been $51 billion. If you get rich, you don't reinvest in Russia, by and large. The first wave of oligarchs was in the 90s, but many options still remain. Levels of wealth are beyond imagination, and it's critically important that you remind yourselves that our society, for all of its foibles, is an environment in which wealth is actually tolerated a great deal better than in Russia generally. So it's a far more dangerous place to be if you're wealthy, that is Russia, as opposed to the United States. And there are a host of reasons why it is that people wouldn't reinvest in the Russian economy. Bricks and mortar developments, substantial projects, mean essentially that the tax authorities can find you. And that can be a pretty harrowing proposition. Roman Abramovich, worth $8.5 billion, bought the Chelsea Football Club. That's the yacht that he brought into New York 2 or 3 weeks ago. It's the largest in the world. It cost him $910 million. Mikhail Prokhorov is worth $9.5 billion. He's the one that bought the Brooklyn Nets and ran feebly, quietly. Imagine he ran for president last March. A year ago March, without ever mentioning Putin or Medvedev. I mean, talk about a passive guy. He got about 1% of the vote. Turn to energy. Cost and payoffs. The world price of oil is directly correlated with Russian GDP, the Russian federal budget, and investment in Russia. One half of all government revenue comes from taxes and oil exports. For every $1 increase or decrease in the world price of oil, it means $1.14 billion in Russian revenue. $1 up or down, $1.14 billion. Gazprom is the largest oil company in the world. Oil and gas business accounts for 75% of Russia's exports. Russia produces more than 10 million barrels of oil a day, and the outdated and ill-maintained infrastructure causes Russia to spill more oil than Kuwait produces. Right? That's how bad the infrastructure is. The recent picture is not so bad for Russia because, of course, world supplies were lost in Syria, Yemen, South Sudan, and Libya. But again, the Russian marketplace depends on instability elsewhere. The near energy future, in 2013, it is projected that there will be a slow decline in production and that the Middle East crisis could offset that, and if it brought $200 a barrel, that the Russian economy would be in good shape. The formula that the Russians are currently using, if oil sells at $60 a barrel, it's a disaster for the Russian economy. If it sells at $80 a barrel, it represents slow growth, economic stagnation, and Russia will be unable to keep pace with the social expenditures that are increasing in that system. Russia needs an increase of 5 to 10 barrels per dollar per year to sustain the current level of their economic activity. At $100 a barrel, that's the minimum level of world sales that will be required to sustain 3 to 4% annual economic growth. The 2030 energy future, insiders forecast. Now, this is a forecast that comes from the economic development minister of Russia today, a very bright woman. She says long-term Russia needs to prepare for a long, cold winter. The future of Moscow as a financial market will be precluded by the narrow base of the Russian economy. She assesses that diversity is unlikely. The options that Russia has discussed is to become a high-center tech, a tourist mecca, a consumer goods manufacturer. None of those are likely. None of those are probable at all. The best option for Russia, the Russian economy, is to become a value-added oil and energy exporter. The oil industry predictions, the global predictions, are that Russia can't deliver the projected volumes of oil. Growing domestic consumption is putting pressure on oil and gas exports inside Russia. The estimated rainy day fund that they're beginning to set aside could save the day, but only if managed properly. If those of you in the industry know that the Norwegians have set aside a rainy day fund for the advent of technologies that would cause the world to be less dependent on oil and gas. And if this were managed effectively, the Russians could accumulate $2.3 trillion potentially. But again, most experts don't think it'll ever be managed properly or effectively. And finally, in world perspective, the global consumption is mushrooming. It's said that the industry tells us that for every barrel of oil discovered in the world, 3 barrels of oil are consumed. So Russia's global role essentially is, the overall strategy is as follows. Foreign policy should be challenging and assertive, but not confrontational. Foreign policy should be independent, searching for opportunity and leverage. The system should be risk-averse and rule-sensitive. That is to say, it should act like a global citizen. It should be comfortable with weaknesses revealed. And that foreign policy, and this is the key, foreign policy must serve the needs of the domestic economy. So if one is analyzing Russian foreign policy, trying to figure out why it is that they have this policy towards Syria or China or someplace else, the way to look, the prism, the lens to use is the issue or issues associated with the domestic economy. The most quoted Putin statement, I'm sure you've heard it before, any Russian who doesn't honor the past has no soul. Any Russian who wants to return to the past has no brain. And it's critically important that you understand that Putin doesn't subscribe to the Western scholars' notions about democracy and authoritarian systems. The plans for 2020, I won't belabor the point, but you've got a list of innovations here that are remarkably unrealistic. And this is what the system is selling to Russians for 2020. Notice the next presidential election will take place before that comes due, right, in 2018. So, by way of conclusion here, Russia faces complex challenges. It has a stable leadership, and I think that's the very good news. Maybe not the perfect leadership from our perspective, but a stable leadership. And that leadership is searching for delicately balanced solutions. They're forward-facing, and although the last slide suggests a lack of realism, there is some pragmatism in their vision. The business environment is partially developed. Leadership, the current leadership recognizes and acknowledges problems and is open to foreign solutions. In particular, they're turning to the West for solutions in agriculture, manufacturing, and innovation. For those of you considering a business relationship, it requires immensely refined due diligence. You have to know, one, who your partners are, in definitive terms, and second, you have to make sure that all of the business partners are in for the long term. Which leads us to perhaps the most useful thing to carry away, a passage by Anton Chekhov, where he reminds us that Russians love the past, hate the present, and fear the future. I'd be happy to field any of the questions that you've got from there.
Dr. Farkas, I have a couple questions. One, you mentioned the oil industry infrastructure is not being kept up, and I'm curious as to what the thinking is that they don't, when that would increase their profits. They can use their current profits to do that. And secondly, at one time, the reduced population per year in Russia was something like 400,000 per year, and I don't know if it's still that. And are they cranking that into their thinking for the future?
Well, I think if Vladimir Putin were here, he'd tell you that pipelines don't vote. The bottom line is that the social expenditures, how can I frame this? They have such a tax shortfall. What happened after the collapse of communism? Various levels of government all independently established tax rates. Remember, in the old centrally planned economy, there was no taxes virtually, because the simple fact is if you control prices and wages, you always have a surplus to run the government. So communism ceases to exist, central planning ceases to exist. Now they have to turn to the conventional way of raising government revenue. What happened is that the towns, the villages, the rayons, the districts, the republics, and the federal government all created their own legislators. Remember, these are legislators without experience. They all created their own tax structures to the point where if you ran a business in Russia, let's say in 1994, the total tax bite was over 100% of your revenue if you paid all your taxes. So what do? Do you pay some taxes? No, because you're fearful that the tax authorities will share the information. So you don't pay any of your taxes. So throughout the 90s, for example, the average percentage of companies and individuals that paid their taxes in Russia was less than 20%. And most of those were foreign companies that went in and weren't prepared to risk not paying their taxes and did it on a different rationale. So Putin comes into office in 2000, and after a year or two, his economic advisors tell him to reduce the tax bite to a solid 12% for everybody. I mean, from 130% of your revenue to 12% of your profit. The most liberal in the world. People still didn't pay. And he went nuts, essentially. He said to his economic advisors, why isn't anyone paying? Because the government refused to guarantee that that rate wouldn't change. So everybody assumed that the rate was put down so people would declare their incomes and then they'd face a terrible bite. The bottom line here is that for all of the years since Russia was the Soviet Union, the average revenue projected by government that actually gets generated from taxes is less than one-third of what they budget. So they get less than one-third of all the money they anticipate. Now, that has implications for the military, for people's salaries, and, of course, for expenditures. So when you ask a perfectly sensible question, why don't they fix the infrastructure, the answer is, well, there's that or pensions or paying the teachers or putting boots. Yeltsin promised that every soldier should have a pair of boots in 1995. I mean, that's really quite remarkable. So the squeeze, I guess the picture I'm trying to paint for you is that the squeeze on expenditures was so tight that the argument is essentially that we can manage, patch the infrastructure. Let's get by. Let's defer maintenance. I mean, there are certainly companies here that can relate to tough times, lack of revenue, business is down, we defer maintenance. So I think it's a really tough spot that they're in. And while I could certainly rationalize different kinds of decisions, they've been pretty consistent. And it is a voting democracy, in a sense. They need to massage people so that they turn out at the polls to renew the leadership. Yes?
Relationship with China.
Yeah, difficult. I think it's easily charted by understanding the soft currency export issues that they have. I think you could count on your two hands, your fingers of your two hands, the number of products that they can competitively export. And as a result, they're in a very tough spot. They get pressured constantly, especially from the Siloviki, that in the foreign trade they have to sell what they prefer to call second-tier military equipment, diesel submarines and tanks and planes of various sorts. It's one of the few things that they have been able to generate reliable customers. And they demand, to their credit, hard currency payments for those sorts of things. So I think there's very, in my estimation, there's very little political texture to the relationship between Russia and China. There's a very, very strong relationship that's driven by short-term and medium-term commercial and trade elements in the system. Yes?
Yes, I just wanted to ask a similar question. On the relations between North Korea and Russia, I understand that you're talking about oil and complex relationships. This is also a complex relationship between Russia and North Korea. What do you think their stance is now that, with everything going on between the North and the South? What's their stance going to be in the future?
Yeah. Well, my sense is that there is not there's not an intimate relationship between the North Korean regime and the Russian regime, first. And I think they're quite comfortable staying well distanced from that. The Russian administration, I think, has said pretty clearly that it's a mess and that they'd prefer to have China stick its nose in and take its risks and deal with its liabilities. So I think the Russians are certainly watching very closely, but I don't think they have the kind of influence that would that they'd want to spend, the kind of capital that they'd want to spend to try to become the hero in that negotiation. So I think they're just going to keep their distance and let us struggle with it, let the Chinese and the Japanese and the South Koreans struggle with the uncertainty.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, Russia is frequently seen as the most distant member of the BRICS group, and It is, when we talk about Russia, we usually focus on the U.S.-Russia relationship, but it is common to left the BRICS variable out of the equation. How do you think that the current Russian administration see the BRICS group, and how do you think Russia fits in that group, and what role would the BRICS as a group play in the future of Russia?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's a very interesting question. If you think about what it is that's in common to all of those so-called BRIC, or if you add T for Turkey or something else for a couple of other places, there's a second tier of places like Vietnam that seem to be growing, developing markets. I think the Russians all view those as very inviting commercial markets. These are countries with dynamic economies, large. They're large countries with large populations, and the Russians, I think, are eager to sell to some of those places because, of course, they all have, even China, whose currency is a soft currency, has a lot of hard currency because of the level of consumption that we have for their products. So I guess what I'm saying is that the Russians would identify those countries as the most, that is the highest priority subset of markets. So I think if you were looking at it from a commercial or economic perspective, there's a real eagerness. They would include Venezuela, certainly Turkey, Vietnam, Indonesia, you know, all of those places. So I think there's an eagerness there. I don't think there's anything, if you were to search for a common political element among those places, you wouldn't find it. But that's not what's driving Russian foreign policy today. Listen, I want to thank you very much for your attention and your patience. It's, of course, always a little frustrating for all of us, given that there's a great deal more to be said about most of these things. But I'm hoping that it'll stimulate your interest in staying tuned in to what is an increasingly complex and important part of our world.